Welcome to the Sports Medicine Podcast, brought to you by the Sidney and J.L. Huffines Institute for Sports Medicine and Human Performance in the Department of Health and Kinesiology at Texas A&M University. At the Huffines Institute, we're always working to facilitate, apply, and bring you the most up-to-date coverage of the wide world that is sports medicine and human performance, all in a language you can understand and share with your friends. And now, here's our host, the director of the Huffines Institute, Dr. Tim Lightfoot.
Well, hello, and welcome to the weekly edition of the Huffines Institute for Sports Medicine's podcast of the week. We are back from our summer vacation, and we're so glad that you all have taken the time to download us and listen. Today, as we have every week since we initiated this podcast about 3.5 years ago, we have a very interesting individual in the world of sports medicine and human performance, Dr. Karen Esser, who is the director of the Center for Muscle Biology at the University of Kentucky. Welcome to the podcast, Karen.
Well, thank you. It's great to be here.
Well, we're glad to have you. I'm going to tell the audience a little bit more about you, and then we'll just jump into the podcast. Dr. Esser has a PhD from the University of Michigan. As I noted, she is a professor at the University of Kentucky and a director of the Center for Muscle Biology. And she has some really interesting things going on with a muscle growth project, the circadian rhythm project, and all those other things that we're going to get into. And so it sounds like it's going to be a fun conversation. So tell us a little bit, how did you get into, and why are you interested in muscle biology?
That's a good question, but I'd say... So I was a field hockey player as an undergraduate at Wake Forest University, and was coming in one afternoon from practice and ran into some people that were working in the human performance lab and struck up a conversation. And at that time, many years ago, they had a cardiac rehab program. So that really changed my professional career because I was sophomore in college, and I started working in the cardiac rehab program. And at that time, I was involved in ECG preparation. Mm-hmm. So that got me thinking about just the adaptability of humans, exercise. I was an athlete, so that was very relatable. But the sort of focus on muscle really came in my PhD work at Michigan. Mm. So when I started my PhD there, was working with Tim White's lab. And there's a lot about having that rich environment. So we had a number of people at Michigan, John Faulkner, Bruce Carlson, any number of people that were just sort of world experts in muscle regeneration. And it just fascinated me how muscle could just sort of adapt and adjust to both use and disuse.
Mm-hmm. It is really cool to tissue because, again, it gets bigger and gets better in so many ways. Mm-hmm. It had been interesting to watch the field of exercise physiology over the years, how there was so much focus on aerobic fitness and so forth. And now it's really very specific. And there's a lot more people looking at muscle now than there has been in the past.
Right.
Why do you think that is?
Well, I think one issue, I can remember having a conversation with the provost at University of Illinois Chicago about this, and why were we studying hypertrophy and why weren't we doing more in terms of endurance? And I think the point that I made with her is that if my dad or my mother isn't strong enough to get out of the chair, if they don't have the strength, if they don't have the power to initiate the movement, then endurance is sort of meaningless.
Right.
And I think as we've seen with the aging population, me being part of the baby boom contingent here, loss of lean mass, loss of strength, changes in quality of life, increases in mortality, falls, all those kinds of things. I think the issue of strength has sort of come more center stage.
Right. When we talk about human performance, so many people think we're just talking about athletes. But in reality, we're not. We're talking about healthy living in general,
correct,
especially for an older population.
Absolutely. And one of the things that we're doing at the University of Kentucky Center for Muscle Biology is actually looking at the role of muscle weakness and wasting in a variety of chronic diseases. So liver disease is another one where the progression is really not very pleasant. The physicians really have no good management plan until they can transplant somebody. And muscle is such a large compartment in the system, and the muscle gets weak, and these patients just start spiraling. So we're looking at trying interventions, obviously not to fix the liver disease per se, but that if we can improve muscle strength and mobility, this will have an effect on the progression of the disease.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
If nothing, the quality of life, obviously.
And so that provides a really good justification for certainly why you have the Center for Muscle Biology. mm-hmm. at the University of Kentucky. Yeah, tell us a little bit more about that. Tell us about the center and what you guys are doing.
Yeah, so the center is great. It's been a lot of fun. I mean, actually, it was started by someone I think that has been here before, Dr. Michael Reed. Mm-hmm. He came in as the chair of physiology, I think, in 2003 at the University of Kentucky, and I was in the first cohort of new recruits, mm-hmm. faculty recruits to the department, and his vision was to create a strength in skeletal muscle and or stride
that's
muscle.
That's a nice pun, by the way. Strength in skeletal muscle. Yes. Yes.
Yes. Yes. We were a strong muscle, not weak muscle. But and so it was really an exciting opportunity to have really well-established, you know, outstanding research scientists as colleagues, but in a way that was complementary. Mm. So, you know, having people that study stem cells or satellite cells versus, you know, in Mike's regard, reactive oxygen and wasting and other, we have some biophysicists. We actually, the members of the center cross 8 different colleges on campus. So we bring it, you know, so muscle is part of meat. So we have people from agriculture come over and they care about it. Maybe not exactly like we do, but and they do care. I think as the director, I took over director in 2010. Mm-hmm. And I think the main role that I have is actually working with the membership to try to help, you know, sort of coalesce resources as I can from College of Medicine and identify ways to help some of the basic science and some of the people doing more applied work kind of work together, sort of set up research teams in areas. So maybe that'll be stroke rehabilitation. So we have some people working with stroke patients. We have others, like I said, with the liver disease contingent. Aging is an area that we have some strengths. And so really trying to help people achieve their research goals, but also growing the impact of the center. And that includes both, you know, sort of funding as well as outreach. We work with YMCAs and some of the, and helping them with some of their programs. In particular, I'm working with a colleague in kinesiology. We're going down to work with kids down in Clay County, Kentucky, which is a very rural and very impoverished county. If anybody had read, there was an article in the New York Times about 10 of the worst counties in the United States in terms of socioeconomic, health status, education, and Clay was in the bottom 5. Wow. So this is a really tough county, but working with these kids, we see an opportunity to hopeful to improve things like their activity levels and getting them engaged in sort of math, science, health related things. So the center's activities really range from things in the hospital to community outreach and everything in between.
Yeah. So you really described your role as an administrator very well. So tell us.
That's sad.
Tell us what. Well, no, it's necessary.
Yeah,
as we
yeah,
know, as
yeah.
you and I both know in this business. So tell us what gets you up in the morning as far as your science goes.
Oh, my gosh.
What are you really passionate about? And we've got a couple areas on my cheat sheet here, but
circadian stuff. Oh,
sure.
Absolutely.
So tell us about what circadian is. Are those the things in the trees that make noise?
Exactly. So circadian rhythms. I think it's just been as I say to many people, it was an accidental scientific change of directions. Mm. So as you referred to, my lab historically had been studying how skeletal muscle senses mechanical tension, how it takes that mechanical information and converts it into a anabolic or a growth response. Mm-hmm. So basically, why does weightlifting work and give you bigger muscles, right? Mm. In the process, we were doing one of the first generation sort of unbiased gene array profiling experiments in the early 2000s and looking for genes in muscle that were changing when we did high force contractions. And fortunately, in those days, we weren't looking at tens of thousands of genes. We were only looking at 8,000, so it was a lot easier to sort of manually look through the list.
Yeah, nowadays, you get a readback of 8,000, and you go, I don't know where to start
with
this.
Where do I start
with this?
Yeah. But I can even remember where I was sitting in my office, and I looked at this one gene, and the name of the gene was BMAL, BMAL1. And I'm just like, I don't know what this is. And just started, you know, thankfully we had PubMed. So you went in and did PubMed. In the old days, I would have had to walk to the library. And the more I looked into this, the more fascinating it got. So this was a gene that was involved in what is called the molecular clock, so a timekeeping mechanism in cells. And that historically is believed had been believed to be only in the brain. But here it was changing in our muscle. And fortunately for our design, our control was actually from the contralateral non-stimulated limb. Mm. So it was we actually had controlled for time in there, which was an accident, a fortuitous one.
But, yeah, science works like that, though,
doesn't
it? It
does,
yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. And so there are a number of things that just got me very passionate about this. One was the fact that circadian rhythms are ubiquitous on the planet Earth. Mm. So they're in bacteria, they're in plants, they're in, you know, insects, and they're in humans. Mm. As someone that had training in biology, and a physiologist, it's like, well, why would they still be in muscle if it didn't matter?
Right.
And but the other fortuitous and lucky part of this was I sent off, so I was reading a review, fascinated. One of the authors of the review was a guy by the name of Joe Takahashi. So I, you know, just didn't know who he was, dropped him an email and just said, look, we're seeing this gene change in skeletal muscle after contractions. And, you know, you're a clock person. What do you think? And he responded within a half an hour.
Hmm.
And I often wonder if he never responded, I just would have walked away. And so he was enthusiastic because that was the time they were realizing that cells outside the brain had clocks.
Hmm.
So the field has been very sort of, at least from the mammalian side, it's very neuroscience oriented. And so I ended up doing a sabbatical, which I recommend to any academic person, and just take a break from what you're doing, go up and immerse yourself in something that you just get really excited about.
Yeah, go do something different for a little while.
What's been really fun about this is the fact that part of circadian behavior is physical activity. So this is also bringing me full cycle. So I have, you know, I started it as a, I had a master's degree in exercise physiology. My PhD is in kines. You know, I've been a muscle scientist or biologist or physiologist for many years. But now by moving into circadian rhythms, I'm actually able to logically bring the whole training together.
Mm.
And it's fun, you know. Mm-hmm. So the idea that activity is all a part of something that's naturally kind of timed and programmed in us.
Right.
And conversely, what time we're active actually feeds back information to the clock systems in our body.
Really?
Yeah. So this is something I'll be presenting some today at the seminar. But I think this, it's gotten me thinking about most of us don't think about what time we do things as actually mattering, you know, whether we do it at 8 o'clock in the morning or 8 o'clock at night, as long as you get it done, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a growing body of literature that says, no, there's a difference. And so I think the fact that exercise actually feeds into the timing and the synchronization between organ systems within the body provides an interesting but very hypothetical model where one of the roles of physical activity could be to help support systems talk,
mm-hmm.
systems interactions,
mm-hmm.
systems synchronization.
Do you think it would also help like training responses?
Oh, yes.
I mean, on a personal level, I know if I run in the morning, early in the morning, it's terrible usually. I do not like running early in the morning. But if you get me afternoon, I'm good.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I feel good about running.
Yep.
I usually perform better,
yep.
et cetera, et cetera. So does the difference in the time of the day not only support different systems, but it changed your training responses?
Absolutely. So the data that's out there right now, so there's some groups in Europe, and I apologize because I don't remember their names right now, but they've actually done some really nice studies with humans and showing that you are stronger in the afternoon than you are in the morning. And they've coupled that with looking at, you know, because I thought, well, you know, you're just sleepy, you don't want it, your brain's
right.
not working.
Right.
But based on the data with EMGs, it would argue, no, it's not EMGs. It's actually potentially coming from the muscle itself.
Mm.
And so there's that. And if I talk to most people that I know that do weightlifting, almost all of them, unless they have to work out in the morning, they all go in the afternoon.
Mm.
The other thing, though, too, that you raise, because I'm a morning runner, so I'm reverse of you.
Right.
So if you try to make me run at 3 in the afternoon, I can do it, but it feels horrible,
bad,
right?
Yeah.
So we all have, so this is the mess that is humanity. We have different, what are referred to as chronotypes. And
okay.
then they, generalizable, there's the lark and the owl. So there are those people that are early morning larks, and there are those people that are owls. And, you know, there are obviously a lot of overlap between that, but, you know, I can even look in my lab. I know those that, you know, is hard as they try, getting into the lab at 10 o'clock in the morning is probably the best they can do. But they're going to also stay until later at night.
Right, right.
Whereas I'm more like, you know, I like getting going at 6 in the morning. But once you get me past 7 or 8 at night, then, you know, don't ask me to think too hard because, you know, unless there's a grant due the next day.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
We all make exceptions for grants, right?
Yes, yeah.
So does the physical performance, is that correlated with cognitive performance as well? Because I think I do better cognitively in the morning.
Right.
Whereas I do physically
I don't know
in the afternoon.
That's a great question. And I am not aware of anybody that's actually tried to look at both of those in the same population. So I don't know the answer to that. I think it depends.
on the individual.
I mean, there's actually some big movements going on right now in terms, I mean, because one of the other ways that one can look at this is if you look at maturation. So during adolescence, there is a huge shift in the timing of the clock from, you know, sort of elementary school years to high school years. And if you look around now, high schools are starting to start later. And so what they found is, you know, that young people in that age bracket, it's more natural for them to go to bed later, to wake up later. So if they actually get school to start later, they're seeing changes in ACT scores, SAT scores, that kind of thing. And so, and sort of saying, look, they're not being lazy. This is their biology that's driving their sleep patterns.
Right. So how does a master clock regulator in a muscle regulate performance or the strength?
Yeah, no, it, well, so...
Is it through a neural system, or...?
What we know at this point is that every single cell in your body has its own clock. So if you think of it, each cell has its own watch, and that watch is going to work on approximately 24-hour cycle. What we have learned is that what that clock is doing in terms of this timekeeping is it is targeting... You know, it's arguably 10 to 20% of the genes in that one cell. And so you'll see very dramatic changes in a cohort of genes from day to night. So you can see 4 to 5-fold differences in, let's say, a troponin, a part of the muscle thin filament system. One of the troponins is under circadian control, so it's going to be higher during the dark phase and lower during the light phase. And so, one... Could, I mean, I can't say I can sit here and molecularly explain how the clock is affecting strength yet, but we can come up with some hypotheses that, there's also a tight link between that clock and metabolism. So, you know, what we know going from sort of in terms of humans, going from day to night, we shift our preferred substrate. Some of that is behaviorally, but some of it's the clock that, it just says, okay, we're now going into the night. We're now going to start switching over into more fat, less carbohydrate as a fuel. And so I think when you time some of these metabolic changes with athletic performance, you know, if you're switching, you know, if you're going for power and fast and your body's saying, no, I'm just going to hang out over here in fat metabolism.
Yeah, that's right.
There's, I mean, it's not that you can't do the performance, but it probably is not going to feel as peak. Yeah. You're not going to peak on that.
Well, that also, I would think, have some interesting applications about performance in general when you're talking about individual in competition.
Absolutely.
Or teams in competitions. I mean, what do you do if you're a coach? And,
right.
And you're hearing this podcast going, oh, my gosh, that's another factor I hadn't even thought of that we've got to control for.
So someone in the circadian field took baseball, Major League Baseball, and looked back over the years at the data on records from teams traveling from west to east. So what we know from the circadian field is it is harder to do the what we call a phase advance. So that would mean taking someone from California and dropping them off in Boston. The adjustment that way is more difficult than if I go from Boston to California. And so what he did was he looked at those teams that were going from west to east and then had to play that night or that next day, and the win-loss records were just, it was, I mean, it was a fun study. It was not scientifically controlled, but it clearly suggested that performance was impaired in that first game after that travel. I actually know some colleagues in the horse industry, being in Kentucky and thoroughbred land, and they pay a lot of attention to make sure that the animals get to the track at least a few days before performance. And I think people, you know, when you look at what countries do before the Olympics, I think, you know, adjusting to food, adjusting, you know, part of that is adjusting circadian. Some of it is you know, sort of more cultural. But, you know, getting into a regular sleep-wake pattern, getting into a regular eating pattern, all of that helps support sort of keeping your circadian system synchronized.
Yeah, fascinating stuff. One of the fun things about you and I, at our phases of our careers, we can look back and see all the things that are different now than we went when we went to school.
Mm-hmm.
So when we talk about muscle biology, what's a big one that really sticks out to you? Obviously, the circadian rhythm stuff that is really changing a lot. But what is the biggest fundamental change you've seen in the understanding of muscle biology?
I would say, you know, I think the whole concept that muscle, like other tissues, is an endocrine organ. So it's secreting, and I think we're just at the tip of the iceberg on that one. And so, I mean, when muscle contributes 40% to your body mass, then, you know, one muscle by itself may not be much, but when you combine all that, it actually can have a very profound effect on the system. So I think that's, like I said, we're starting to see some of that. I think that's just going to continue to grow. So muscle doing things beyond just generating force.
You just blew up the heads of several biology teachers that listened to this,
yeah.
Right?
I know. Well, yeah. And I, you know,
that's okay, though. That's the fun stuff, right?
I guess I'm obviously very biased by my role as, well, both by my role as a scientist and kind of living in muscle, but also as the director of the center. I think, you know, one of our goals is to get people to, and when I say people in the healthcare industry, because most clinicians or anybody in healthcare, apart from physical therapists, don't get background in muscle.
Right. Right.
You know, you get cardiovascular, you get neuroscience, but muscle's just not, you don't get exercise, maybe you get a little nutrition. One of the things I always say is that I think we are starting to come into the time that muscle will have a place in healthcare. And especially when we think of chronic diseases and aging and all these things, I think this is going to become important. I don't know, it's funny you say that, because I can remember a cell biology teacher in my graduate program at Michigan, when we got to the muscle section, he just said, we know everything there is to know about muscle. You know, there's actin, there's myosin. Yeah, let's go on. And you know, there's still, you know, a lot to learn and from a performance perspective, but also from a healthcare perspective.
You know? And all you have to do is look at the literature now when you're talking about sarcopenia and muscle wasting and the emphasis on that and how that's
cancer
becoming.
Cancer cachexia.
Yeah, such a prominent role. Well, Karen, it's been great to have you here today. Thank you so much for being with us.
It's been a lot of fun.
What we do with our guests is we give them an opportunity to give us a take-home message. The one thing that you want the audience to remember after they've listened to this podcast.
Boy, one thing is a hard one for me. But, okay, so if there's one thing you're going to take home from this podcast, time of day matters.
Mm.
And you know, sleep matters, time of day matters, and to your health.
Excellent. Good take-home message. Thank you again for being with us. Thanks for being here at A&M, too.
It's been great
to have you. And I want to thank all of you that have been listening for taking the time to download us. If you're a regular listener to the podcast, you know this is the time when we turn the podcast over somewhat dangerously at times to our producers, and they give us the podcast take-home question of the week.
What travel adjustment is harder on sports teams, west to east or east to west?
Well, thank you, Aylin, for that question. And again, the first person to email us the correct answer at huffinespodcast@hlkn.tamu.edu will win one of our nifty podcast t-shirts, and we actually have the new editions in, so send those emails quickly. Again, thank you all for taking the time to download and listen to us, and we hope that you join us next week when we have another interesting person in the world of sports medicine human performance with us. And until then, we hope you stay active and healthy.
The Sports Medicine Podcast is produced by Kelly Selman and Aylind Letzinger and licensed by the Huffines Institute at Texas A&M under a Creative Commons 3.0 license. You can share it as much as you want, and you can talk or blog about it all you want. Just don't change it or charge money for it. This podcast is made possible by support from the Omar Smith family and the Sidney and J.L. Huffines family.
Our music was composed, performed, and graciously provided by Dave Zeltner Productions, your source for quality music and music production since 1992. Find them at www.davidzeltner.com. Our opening and closing credits were provided by johnmilesproductions.com. If you have questions or comments, please send them to huffinespodcast@hlkn.tamu.edu. From all of us at the Huffines Institute, we hope you have an active and healthy week.